another 2 decades before any use for glyphosate was found. After Johnson & Johnson bought Silac, it sold off several of its research samples, including its glyphosate work, and, like an unwanted stray, glyphosate was sold again by a company called Aldrich Chemical. Stouffer Chemical Company was perhaps the first to find value in glyphosate, identifying it as a chemical chelator, something that could bind with minerals such as calcium, manganese, copper, and zinc. But it took Monsanto Company's chemists to unlock the magic of the molecule as a powerful and ultimately high-profitable herbicide. The glory for that discovery would go to John Franz, a zealous young scientist who would later tell interviewers that he had known he wanted to be a chemist from the age of 10. Franz joined Monsanto in 1955 as his first job after obtaining a doctorate in organic chemistry at the University of Minnesota. He worked on an assortment of projects for Monsanto, which at that time was primarily a maker of industrial chemicals. Franz's work included research into polymer flame retardants. In 1967, Franz was a fresh transfer into Monsanto's agricultural division, working alongside Phil Hamm, head of the company's herbicide screening program. The company had been testing different compounds as potential water softening agents when it found that 2 molecules showed some herbicidal activity. Weed killers, as well as other pesticides, were in high demand at the time, part of an exploding, technology-driven modernization of agriculture and food production. Hamm assigned Franz to analyze these intriguing molecules more closely, and the young scientist ultimately synthesized derivatives into a chemical that could act as a powerful plant growth inhibitor. Glyphosate was considered a novel and highly effective new herbicide. When sprayed on a weed, it travels to the roots and disrupts a critical enzyme produced by plants and microorganisms, known as 5-enolpyruvyl-shikimate-3-phosphate, EPSP, synthase. Plants require this enzyme to produce the building blocks they need to grow. Without them, the plant withers and dies. Even a few drops of glyphosate can kill an otherwise healthy plant within a few days. In addition to its effectiveness, glyphosate was determined by Monsanto scientists to be much safer and better for the environment than other herbicides in use. The enzyme glyphosate disrupts was not known to be present in mammals or birds, so while it was toxic to plants, it was safe for people and animals, according to Monsanto. Monsanto's research team had been searching for nearly a decade for an herbicide that could stop both annual and perennial weeds, so the potential unlocked with glyphosate was quickly embraced by company officials. The first tests of its herbicidal prowess took place in a greenhouse in July 1970, and were so successful that company officials quickly became convinced the discovery could revolutionize the market for herbicides, which had expanded rapidly after World War II. On March 26, 1974, the U.S. Patent Office issued a patent to Franz as the assigner to Monsanto that described the benefits of his invention. The compositions of this invention provide a wide spectrum of weed control and also extremely useful as general herbicides, as well as in controlling unwanted plants in orchards, tree farms, and various crops. Franz ultimately found himself showered with awards for his work with the weed killer, including a National Medal of Technology and Innovation bestowed on him by President Ronald Reagan in 1987. Franz told an interviewer for the National Science and Technology Medals Foundation that he found great satisfaction in developing an environmentally friendly product that's beneficial to mankind. Glyphosate would later be declared a 1-in-100-year discovery that is as important for reliable global food production as penicillin is for battling disease. Franz was named to the National Inventors Hall of Fame and ultimately would hold over 840 U.S. and foreign patents before retiring from Monsanto in 1991. Franz's discovery came at just the right time for Monsanto. Founded in 1901 by John F. Queeny, the company, named after Queeny's wife, Olga Mendez Monsanto, began as a maker of the artificial sweetener saccharin, and then expanded into a chemical manufacturer of everything from sulfuric acid, polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, and plastics to synthetic fabrics, expanding its reach over the years with a series of acquisitions. By the 1940s, the company was one of several in the business of manufacturing the insecticide dichlorodiphenyltrichloroethane, DDT. And in the 1960s, Monsanto became infamous as one of the primary suppliers to the U.S. government of Agent Orange, a defoliant used during the Vietnam War to kill vegetation that provided cover for the enemy. The herbicide, named for the orange-striped drums used to transport it, was a mixture of chemicals called 2,4-D and 2,4,5-T. And military officials asserted for years that the combination posed little danger to people. But Agent Orange was eventually found to contain the highly toxic contaminant dioxin, a byproduct created during the manufacturing process that is known to cause cancers and disrupt reproduction and development. Lawsuits and controversy persisted decades after the war ended, with both Vietnamese and U.S. service personnel alleging that Agent Orange caused a litany of ills, including non-Hodgkin lymphoma, prostate cancer, and other diseases. The U.S. government eventually acknowledged the herbicide's role in a wide range of cancers and health problems. By the 1970s, Monsanto was trying to put the dark cloud of dioxins behind it, and it had an agricultural division underway aimed at adding new herbicides to the company's product line. Weed killers branded with names such as Ramrod and Lasso, invoking images of a toughened cowboy, appeared in the 1960s, and company scientists were racing for more. When Roundup was rolled out in the 1970s, there was little doubt it would be a hit. Company chemists had combined the active ingredient, glyphosate, with water and the surfactant polyethoxylated tallowamine, POEA, in a formulation that poisoned so effectively that weeds would shrivel and die within days. Many farmers during that era were using herbicides that formed a chemical barrier on the surface soil of a farm field so that weeds would start dying as they emerged through the ground. But these pre-emergent herbicides washed into streams and groundwater, carrying toxic dangers to wildlife and fish. Roundup was different, according to Monsanto and environmental experts. Evidence showed it was one of the most environmentally friendly herbicides in the history of agriculture, the company assured people. Monsanto proclaimed that the new herbicide would break down in the soil easily and safely. Glyphosate was also seen as less volatile than other pesticides and less likely to contaminate the atmosphere. And for people and animals, glyphosate was touted as less toxic than aspirin, the company said. Some enthusiastic advocates even proclaimed glyphosate was safe enough to drink. Monsanto itself wouldn't go that far. "Glyphosate isn't a beverage," the company wrote in a blog post. "But," it said, "all labeled uses of glyphosate are safe for human health." Monsanto geared up for high demand of its Wonder product, seeking federal approval for expanded mining operations in Idaho of phosphorus, an essential ingredient in its glyphosate herbicides. In applying for the permit, Monsanto told the federal government that production was expected to surge. Monsanto had started mining phosphorus in 1952, at a time when the substance was used mainly in detergents, but by the 1970s, it was all about the remarkable new herbicide. The company expected a 50% increase in productions of the phosphates by 1978, a twofold increase in about 1981 or 1982, and a threefold increase in production in 1985. At that time, Monsanto was producing at least 220 million pounds of phosphorus in Idaho. And the company was proved right. The world welcomed its new herbicide. The United Kingdom started using Roundup in wheat production in 1974, becoming the first nation to introduce glyphosate as a tool for food production. In the United States, Roundup initially had been introduced for non-crop uses, and then it was marketed to farmers for use on fields before planting and after harvesting their crops. Malaysia and Canada also quickly adopted Roundup as an answer to weed problems. This was well before the days of the glyphosate-tolerant Roundup-ready crops, which Monsanto developed in the mid-1990s, so farmers had to take care to keep Roundup away from their crops, or they would die alongside the weeds. The original branded Roundup would be named by Farm Chemicals magazine in 1994 as one of the top 10 products that changed the face of agriculture. Wiping out weeds meant crops had more access to soil moisture and nutrients, which typically translated to higher crop yields at harvest time. But farmers weren't the only ones who loved Roundup. Government agencies that needed to control weeds along roads and railroad tracks, homeowners, golf course operators, and business park maintenance staff alike were quick to adopt Roundup as their herbicide of choice. The love affair continued well into the new century. As recently as 2008, Stephen O. Duke, a scientist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Agricultural Research Service, and Australian weed expert Stephen B. Powles, described glyphosate as environmentally benign, virtually ideal, and a once-in-a-century herbicide. The writing was already on the wall at that point, as scientific evidence of glyphosate's unintended impacts on the environment and human health was mounting in study after study. But it would not be until 2015 and the World Health Organization's classification of glyphosate as a probable human carcinogen that the world's ardor for glyphosate would turn cold. There were early warnings, of course, but only a few. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, was still in its infancy back in 1974, when Monsanto marched its new herbicide to the marketplace. The agency had been created in 1970 by President Richard Nixon as an answer to the environmental movement, an attempt to address American angst over revelations of widespread chemical pollution. Nixon's executive order transferred 15 units from four other government agencies to form the newly minted EPA. The move wasn't an easy one. Staffers were forced to adjust quickly to new colleagues, nascent policies, and administrative practices, and the issuing of literally thousands of new rules and regulations governing the environment. The EPA itself described that early period as chaos. Amid the chaos, the new agency was charged with tightening pesticide regulation. Soon, lawmakers passed the Federal Environmental Pesticide Control Act of 1972 to strengthen the severely outdated Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, FIFRA, which had been passed in 1947 and provided little protection from long-term exposures. The 1972 law moved pesticides from the purview of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, to the EPA, which was to monitor pesticide residues and strengthen protection of the environment and public health. The idea was to make it easier for the government to ban hazardous pesticides and punish people or companies for improper use. These directives presented a real challenge to the employees who would oversee the new pesticide registration division, most of whom came from the USDA, where a culture of cooperation and affiliation with ag-related corporations was deeply ingrained, and there were efforts to promote the advantages of pesticides. After all, part of the USDA's mission was, and is, to support, sustain, and promote the nation's agricultural industry, everyone from small farmers to the giant seed and chemical companies that sell to the farmers. These people who came from USDA had very close relations with industry people, the big ag companies, said William Sanjor, who worked at the EPA for 30 years until retiring in 2001. Sanjor was one of a group of EPA scientists who accused EPA officials in the 1990s of failing to investigate allegations that Monsanto falsified scientific studies on the carcinogenicity of dioxin. Monsanto's studies had indicated no link between dioxin and cancer, but the EPA eventually classified the chemical as a likely human carcinogen. They saw the industry people as being their clients. Monsanto, people like that, Sanjor said. They very much controlled EPA then, and they still do. Sanjor won a landmark lawsuit in 1995 against the U.S. government that established the First Amendment rights of federal employees to speak out publicly as whistleblowers regarding wrongful actions by their employers. Allegations of collusion aside, regulating pesticides was no easy task, particularly for a new agency that was juggling political and public pressures. It would not be until June 1986, more than a decade after Monsanto's Roundup herbicide was introduced to global markets, that the EPA issued a registration standard for the herbicide. And even then, EPA scientists struggled to find consensus, saying additional studies were needed. The new herbicide was a tough nut to crack. There are actually different salts of glyphosate that can be used in different ways in pesticide products. The main one, known as the isopropylamine salt, is key in controlling broadleaf weeds and grasses in many crops, as well as on residential lawns, in forests, and along roadways. It can be formulated as a liquid or a solid and can be applied from the ground or the air. There is also what scientists call the sodium salt of glyphosate, used with peanuts and sugarcane to modify plant growth and hasten the ripening of fruit. It is applied as a ground spray to peanut fields and as an aerial spray to sugarcane. The monoammonium salt of glyphosate is also used as an herbicide growth regulator, but in only a handful of products. When the EPA looked at glyphosate in the early and mid-1980s, it determined that many types of additional studies were needed as scientists inside the agency wrestled over the significance of tumors in rats and other health problems seen in test animals exposed to glyphosate. But by 1993, the EPA was trumpeting the safety of Monsanto's herbicide. EPA's worst-case risk assessment of glyphosate's many registered food uses concludes that human dietary exposure and risk are minimal. Existing and proposed tolerances have been reassessed, and no significant changes are needed to protect the public. The EPA said it had decided to classify glyphosate as a chemical that shows evidence of non-carcinogenicity for humans based on the lack of convincing evidence of carcinogenicity in adequate studies. Even though glyphosate would be used by farmers, city workers, homeowners, and others, the agency claimed there was no need for data on occupational or residential exposure because regulators did not have concerns about the chemical's toxicity, especially its carcinogenicity. But what the EPA did not say in that 1993 report was that its conclusion of non-carcinogenicity had actually been a reversal of a prior recommendation by EPA scientists who felt there were noteworthy links between cancer and glyphosate, and that the reversal came after prolonged pressure from Monsanto. Critics suspecting collusion demanded to see the data used to justify the EPA's reversal. But for years, the agency refused to make public what it said were corporate trade secrets that must be protected. Hints of what transpired have recently been revealed in EPA memos that lay out the events and in other documents. It was February 11, 1985, 11 years after the Roundup herbicide hit the market, when 8 members of a group called the Toxicology Branch Ad Hoc Committee of the EPA sat down to consider the carcinogenic potential of glyphosate. The group reviewed a packet of materials that included studies showing links between glyphosate exposure and the development of tumors or other problems in test animals. The group also was given a letter from Monsanto dated February 5, 1985, that sought to discount the significance of the tumors. One 1983 study stuck out. Several groups of 50 male and 50 female mice, individually caged, were administered diets that included doses of glyphosate for 24 months. EPA researchers found results that showed a dose-related increase in incidences of renal tubular adenomas in male mice. These kidney tumors were described as a rare type, and the incidence rate seen in the mice exposed to glyphosate compared with the rate seen in control groups of mice not exposed to the pesticide, could not be ignored. Though adenomas are generally benign, non-cancerous, they have the potential to become malignant. Even in non-cancerous stages, they can be harmful to many organs. Review of the mouse oncogenicity study indicates that glyphosate is oncogenic, producing renal tubular adenomas, a rare tumor, in a dose-related manner, a top EPA toxicologist wrote in an internal memorandum. There were a number of other concerning research results, including another study in which thyroid tumors were observed in some female rats and tumors were noted in the testes of male rats. But the agency showed less concern with those results, concluding that the dose levels in the rat feeding research were inadequate to assess the chemical's carcinogenic potential for that species. Still, the scientists were worried enough by the kidney tumors in mice that they ultimately determined glyphosate should be considered a Category C oncogen. An oncogen is defined as a substance that causes tumors to form. And in EPA lingo, Category C translated to possibly carcinogenic to humans. That finding did not sit well with Monsanto, and it soon became clear that the 1985 decision was not going to be the end of the discussion. Monsanto continued to protest that links to cancer were unproven and the kidney tumor concerns were unfounded. On April 3, 1985, George Levenskos, Monsanto's manager for environmental assessment and toxicology, noted in an internal memorandum to another company scientist that the company had arranged for Marvin Kushner, a noted pathologist and founding dean of the medical school at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, to review the kidney tissue slides. Curiously, though Kushner had not yet even accessed the slides, Levenskos implied in his memo that a favorable outcome from Kushner's review was ensured. Kushner will review kidney sections and present his evaluation of them to EPA in an effort to persuade the agency that the observed tumors are not related to glyphosate, Levenskos wrote. Levenskos, who died in 2005, was also involved in efforts a decade earlier to downplay damaging findings from a study that found rats exposed to the company's PCBs developed tumors. Documents filed in PCB litigation revealed. Kushner's subsequent re-examination did, as Monsanto intended, determine the tumors were not due to glyphosate. Looking over slides of the mouse tissue from the 1983 study, Kushner identified a small kidney tumor in one control group of the mice, those that had not received glyphosate. No one had noted such a tumor in the original pathology report. The finding was highly significant, as well as controversial, because it provided a scientific basis for a conclusion that the tumors seen in the mice that were exposed to glyphosate were not noteworthy after all. Additionally, Monsanto provided the EPA with an October 1985 report from a pathology working group that supported Kushner's work and also rebutted the finding of the connection between glyphosate and the kidney tumors seen in the 1983 study. The pathology working group said the outcomes reflected a normal biologic variation and that spontaneous chronic renal disease was commonly seen in aged mice. Monsanto provided the report to the EPA, stamped as a trade secret, to be kept from the prying eyes of the public. The EPA's own scientists did not agree, however, saying that additional examination of the tissue slides did not reveal a tumor in the control group. Still, the reports by the outside pathologists brought into the debate by Monsanto helped push the EPA to launch a re-examination of the research. And by February 1986, an EPA scientific advisory panel had dubbed the findings equivocal. The incidences of tumors were not statistically significant enough to warrant the cancer linkage, though the panel did note that there may be reason for concern. That advisory panel told the EPA that the studies should be repeated in hopes of more definitive findings and that glyphosate should be classified in what the agency at the time called Group D, not classifiable as to human carcinogenicity. That category was used when the agency determined there was an adequate human and animal evidence linking a substance to cancer, or when data were lacking. Later that year, The EPA issued a registration standard that required a range of additional studies to look at toxicology, residues, and environmental issues surrounding glyphosate. The agency specifically asked for a repeat of the mouse oncogenicity study, but Monsanto had no desire to repeat the work and refused to do so. The company argued that there is no relevant scientific or regulatory justification for repeating the glyphosate mouse oncogenicity study. Instead, the company provided EPA officials with historical control data that it argued supported its attempt to further downplay the tumor incidences seen in the worrisome 1983 study. The company said the tumors in mice appear with some regularity and were probably attributable to genetic or environmental factors. It is the judgment of Monsanto scientists that the weight of evidence strongly supports a conclusion that glyphosate is not oncogenic in the mouse. After meetings with Monsanto, the EPA's toxicology branch expressed doubts about the validity of Monsanto's data, but eventually EPA officials conceded, stating that they would drop the requirement for a repeated mouse study. And even though other research acknowledged by the EPA showed apparent ties between glyphosate and blood and pancreatic problems in rats, decreased enzyme production in rabbits, sickness and death in pregnant rats and rabbits, and more, the agency held to a position that there was no significant evidence of danger. The narrative became so entrenched in the EPA that when a review committee met on June 26, 1991, to again discuss and evaluate glyphosate research, the group decided that there was a lack of convincing carcinogenicity evidence in relevant animal studies. The group concluded that the herbicide should be classified far more lightly than the initial 1985 classification or even the 1986 classification proposed by the advisory panel. This time, the EPA scientists dubbed the herbicide a Group E chemical, a classification that meant evidence of non-carcinogenicity for humans. In a memo explaining the decision, authored by William Dykstra and George Z. Galli, both scientists within the Health Effects Division of the EPA's Office of Pesticides and Toxic Substances, the agency officials offered a caveat. They wrote that the classification should not be interpreted as a definitive conclusion that the agent will not be a carcinogen under any circumstances. Not all the review members agreed with the conclusion in 1991. Of the 17 peer review members involved, at least two did not concur, writing their objection next to their name. A third simply did not sign the document, which stated, "Signature indicates concurrence." Another study examined by the EPA over the course of its glyphosate analysis was one called A Lifetime Feeding Study of Glyphosate, Roundup Technical, in Rats, prepared by Biodynamics Incorporated for Monsanto in 1981. Even though that study showed some tumors in the testes of male rats, as well as possible thyroid carcinomas in females who received high doses of the pesticide, it was determined that the data did not demonstrate noteworthy links between glyphosate and cancer. The study was marked by Monsanto as a trade secret and kept from public scrutiny. The 1983 study that showed kidney tumors in mice was also considered a trade secret. In fact, many of the roughly 290 studies, reports, memos, and letters that the EPA said were relevant to its decision-making on glyphosate at the time were generated or submitted by Monsanto and were unpublished, meaning they were not peer-reviewed and not available for review or analysis by the public and independent scientists. The questions about those kidney tumor conclusions have never been fully resolved, at least in the minds of those who believe Monsanto's influence was ultimately what led the EPA to drop its view of glyphosate as a possible carcinogen. The plaintiffs suing Monsanto over cancer claims allege that only scientists with financial ties to Monsanto have ever affirmed the presence of a tumor in the control group for that mouse study. But Monsanto says the evidence overwhelmingly disproves cancer connections. Some of the research Monsanto provided to the EPA raised red flags in part because fraud had been discovered at two of the laboratories the company used regularly. The deceptions the FDA discovered at the Industrial Biotest Laboratories, IBT, in 1976 were particularly egregious, leading to the repeat of some toxicology studies of many products, including Roundup. In 1983, three IBT officials were convicted of trying to defraud the government by covering up inaccurate research data. During court proceedings, testimony revealed that IBT laboratory workers sometimes substituted new animals for test animals that had died, without noting the deaths or substitutions in lab reports. Plus, entire test data and lab reports for one product were copied into reports for other products. Then there were the so-called magic pencil studies, in which false data were submitted if test results indicated a product's adverse or fatal effects. One of those convicted was a Monsanto insider named Paul L. Wright. Wright was a Monsanto toxicologist before he went to work at IBT as a section head for rat toxicology, and he went back to work for Monsanto after the IBT fraud was exposed. He was actually employed by Monsanto at the time he was convicted. Wright also was involved in IBT's testing of PCBs, and memos that came to light during the government's investigation included discussions of efforts by Monsanto to get test results on PCBs altered to cast its product in a more favorable light. Fraud was also uncovered in 1990 in Craven Laboratories, another lab used by Monsanto to test glyphosate. State and federal investigators found that lab researchers had falsified pesticide residue testing data for at least a decade. Monsanto said that it had all the affected studies done by both Craven and IBT repeated, but critics have little trust in the company-funded reports. Despite the findings of fraud in the laboratories, it was not easy for the EPA's own experts to challenge companies such as Monsanto. EPA scientist Kate Jenkins, who holds a doctorate in chemistry, found that out firsthand in 1990 when she suspected Monsanto's studies on dioxins were fraudulent and had led the EPA to erroneously conclude that dioxins did not cause cancer. Jenkins alerted top officials within the agency to her suspicions, pointing out numerous misrepresentations and falsifications in Monsanto's health studies on dioxins submitted to the agency, which made the chemical seem much safer than it was. She accused the company of covering up dioxin contamination problems and engaging in obvious fraud. Her allegations were shared with Monsanto, which deemed them baseless. In 1991, she pressed the issue again, telling EPA investigators that Monsanto's influence was weakening the EPA's regulation of dioxins. Jenkins was subsequently demoted, an action she responded to by filing a complaint with the U.S. Department of Labor. It took 2 years of battling for her job before she was reinstated. Indeed, safety data for pesticides during the era of glyphosate's introduction were so unsound, so suspect, that in a 1982 article in Mother Jones magazine, Marcia Williams, former director of the EPA's Special Pesticide Review Division, was quoted as saying that none of the 600 chemicals which have been registered have adequate data to support them. Despite the concerns, by September 1993, the EPA had given a green light to Monsanto and glyphosate for a wide range of uses, citing the chemical safety for humans, animals, birds, bees, and aquatic animals alike. The agency's only noted concern? The potential hazard to the Houston toad. As the agency stated in a 259-page description of its stance on glyphosate, the endangered species was facing a host of modern-day development threats, including pesticide use, officials found. And in a move that would later fuel criticism, the EPA's safety declarations were largely based on glyphosate alone, not on how it affects people, animals, and the environment when it is mixed with other ingredients, as it is branded in herbicide formulas such as Roundup. Research has shown that these combinations of glyphosate with other chemicals might be more dangerous than glyphosate alone. By 2016, European and U.S. regulatory authorities would be talking about the need to more thoroughly examine these formulated products. The whole pesticide approval process is so narrowly focused on individual ingredients that no one at the EPA has taken a step back to look at the bigger picture. And when you look at the bigger picture, it's clear that the agency has created a monster, said Nathan Donnelly, who holds a doctoral degree in cell and developmental biology. Pesticide labels are so permissive regarding what a pesticide can be mixed with that no one really has any clue about what is being mixed with what and where. The EPA treats pesticide mixtures as something to be swept under the rug. They pay lip service to it every once in a while, but when it comes to actually doing something about it, they revert back to the decades-old practice of pretending that it doesn't exist. With the EPA, lack of evidence of harm equals no harm when it comes to mixture toxicity. It's just indefensible. One reason for the EPA's apparent eagerness to greenlight new pesticides is a little-known provision in the agency's statute that calls for the EPA to examine not only how a pesticide affects human and environmental well-being, but also how it affects the financial well-being of agricultural players. As startling as that may be to consumers, it's a fact that protecting public health and the environment is only part of the equation when the EPA decides whether or not to allow pesticides to market. Many people assume the EPA's sole role is to look at potential hazards, health or otherwise, when evaluating pesticides such as glyphosate. But under the law, the EPA must balance risks against benefits, weighing whether or not a pesticide creates an unreasonable risk to man or the environment, taking into account the economic, social, and environmental costs and benefits of the use of any pesticide. The EPA does a risk-benefit analysis, taking into account that even though pesticide use entails some risk, pesticides provide substantial benefits to society. As the agency wrestled over safety concerns with glyphosate, it also was busy figuring out how much of the pesticide would legally be allowed into the food supply. Not coincidentally, many of the studies and reports Monsanto provided to the EPA concerned the fact that using glyphosate in farming was bound to leave glyphosate residues in food. The fact that the agency reversed its earlier view that glyphosate could be a possible carcinogen was key, because food safety laws frowned on allowing residues of cancer-causing chemicals in food. By 1991, the company had submitted specific reports aimed at establishing or raising government allowances for glyphosate residues in numerous crops, including corn, soybeans, wheat, potatoes, sorghum, grapes, and dozens of others. Because Roundup was used on tea plantations in Argentina, India, Sri Lanka, Taiwan, and elsewhere, Monsanto even requested allowances for the weed killer in instant tea. Using Monsanto's work as a guide, the EPA set what the agency calls tolerances, essentially benchmarks for levels of glyphosate residues that would be permitted on a range of food crops. Those tolerance levels were tied to how much of the chemical was expected to be used on different crops and how much residue was expected to remain. Over the years, Monsanto requested and received approvals for greater and greater tolerances to dovetail with the increasing amounts of its weed killer being used on food and livestock feed crops, setting up the potential for people and animals to consume higher and higher levels of weed killer in their daily diets. The EPA has made clear that it does not believe that residues pose a threat. The agency states that the chronic dietary risk posed by glyphosate food uses is minimal. And that belief, the EPA's assurance of safety, was cited for years by other federal agencies as a reason why they skipped over glyphosate when conducting annual testing programs specifically designed to make sure pesticide residues on food were within legal limits. Glyphosate got a pass while other, less widely used pesticides did not. Without such tests, there was no way of knowing if the even higher legal levels of glyphosate were being adhered to, or if the food supply was being contaminated with a flood of the weed-killing chemical. The EPA's flexible allowances for levels of glyphosate residues in food would prove to be critical to Monsanto's future as an agricultural powerhouse. By 1993, Monsanto's patent protection on glyphosate was approaching its sunset. It would expire in 2000 in the United States. After that, rivals would be free to offer cheaper generic glyphosate herbicides to compete with Monsanto's Roundup. But Monsanto had a strategy to keep its Roundup sales strong. The company's scientists had figured out how to alter the genetic makeup of soybeans and other widely grown crops so that they could withstand being sprayed directly with glyphosate. These Roundup-ready crops marked the dawning of a new era for agriculture that would quickly and drastically change the face of food production. The EPA's stamp of approval for the safety of Monsanto's Roundup was an essential first step. Monsanto would later cite the EPA's determination that glyphosate did not cause cancer when asking the USDA to approve its new glyphosate-tolerant crops. And by 2001, only 5 years after the introduction of those Roundup-ready crops, glyphosate would be established as the most widely used agrochemical in America. Chapter 3. The Roundup Ready Rollout. Mark Nelson was still a young farmer in the mid-1990s, figuring out the best tools and tactics for coaxing corn, soybeans, and wheat from the farm fields of northeastern Kansas, when he started hearing about a new type of high-tech seed that would soon be for sale. Other farmers Nelson knew were talking about it. So were university extension agents and seed dealers. It seemed everyone was talking about it and waiting for these special seeds that had been transformed by alterations to their DNA. Through the magic of technology, scientists at Monsanto Company had found they could insert genetic material from a strain of Agrobacterium into the chromosome of the soybean, transforming the bean into a crop that could withstand being sprayed with Monsanto's Roundup and still continue to grow and flourish. The company then planted and studied the altered soybean seeds in locations around the United States and in Puerto Rico, Argentina, and Costa Rica through 1991 and 1992, developing a wide range of soybean varieties to commercialize. This was different from the seed breeding of the past, in which scientists crossbred crop species to obtain desired traits, such as hardier and higher-yielding plants. These new crops contain genetic material that had never naturally made its way into a corn or wheat or soy plant. They were the product of high-dollar laboratories where scientists in lab coats pored over petri dishes, and they were patented by Monsanto. Farmers planting these special seeds would no longer be able to save some of the finished crop and replant the seeds, as farmers had for generations. The seeds for these genetically modified organisms, GMOs, had to be purchased new every year, or Monsanto's patent would be infringed. With a wife and three young daughters to provide for, Nelson was wary of the hefty price tag attached to the new specialty seeds and the fact that those costs would repeat each season. But as the agricultural community around him quickly embraced them, so did he. The benefits were obvious. While farmers previously had needed to till the soil to disrupt weed growth, rotate the types of crops they planted year after year, and often treat their entire barren fields with various chemicals to kill weeds before planting, the combination of Roundup herbicide and Roundup Ready crops made farming much easier. By itself, Roundup was a godsend to farmers like Nelson, but it couldn't be used once crops emerged from the ground, because even a light drizzle of the potent pesticide adrift on a breeze could do great damage to a corn or wheat stalk. With the new types of seeds, the herbicide could be used at will. "We said yes. The sticker shock was big," Nelson said. "But the weed control was great." Nelson was already a big fan of Roundup herbicide. It knocked out more weed types more effectively than the other types of herbicides Nelson had tried, and was reassured by the company's assertions that it was better for the environment than rival products. Nelson, who grew up helping his grandfather farm, especially liked that Roundup reduced the need for tilling, a practice known to erode soil and deplete moisture and essential nutrients from the ground. "When it came out, that was all we used," Nelson said of Roundup. "We just used it and used it and used it. We didn't even know what was in it. We never heard the word glyphosate. It was just all Roundup." It was 1996 when Monsanto unveiled its Roundup-ready soybean. Soybeans were, and are, one of the world's largest sources of plant-based protein, ranking as a top crop for farmers and serving as a key ingredient in many types of food for people, pets, and livestock. Soy is commonly found in infant formula, cereals and crackers, rolls and pastries, and even fruit drink mixes and canned soups. It's often used as a meat extender and found in pork link sausages and luncheon meats. And it's used to make an array of products consumed by vegetarians, such as tofu and soy milk. To put it mildly, Monsanto's introduction of the new soybeans spelled a very large market opportunity. And because the soybean was designed to be used in conjunction with Monsanto's branded glyphosate-based Roundup, the profit prospects for the company were enormous. In seeking government approval for Roundup-ready soybeans, Monsanto again touted the safety of its glyphosate pesticide and made clear that selling the new beans was also about selling Roundup. Farmers buying and planting the new beans could take advantage of this herbicide's well-known, very favorable environmental and safety characteristics, Monsanto told the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA. The company reminded regulators that glyphosate is only toxic to plants, but not to other living species, including mammals. But because of their tweaked DNA, these new crops would not die even if sprayed repeatedly with glyphosate. The company had discovered organisms that conferred resistance to glyphosate in the sludge-filled waste ponds surrounding its Roundup production plant in Luling, Louisiana. Monsanto told regulators that its new Roundup-ready system, the herbicide combined with the herbicide-tolerant crops, should save farmers money on fuel, for there would be little need to power up tractors and plow weedy fields. The company also said that the Roundup-ready crop system may reduce overall herbicide use, a statement that would prove to be not just wrong, but colossally so. Herbicide use actually skyrocketed over the 20 years that followed the introduction of Monsanto's Roundup-ready crops, helping Monsanto reap billions of dollars in herbicide sales, on top of the billions of dollars it made from the specialty seed sales. It was a brilliant move for Monsanto, but it was one that environmentalists, scientists, consumers, and regulators would eventually realize came with devastating costs. The Roundup-ready soybean was only the first herbicide-tolerant crop Monsanto would birth from its laboratories. By the year 2000, only 4 short years after the first biotech soybean was brought to market, and the year that Monsanto's U.S. patent on glyphosate expired, Monsanto was also selling Roundup-ready corn, cotton, and canola, all genetically engineered to tolerate being sprayed with glyphosate-based herbicides. The company, which at that time was spending around $500 million annually on research and development, had also developed genetic alterations that created insect-resistant in corn and cotton, and it was combining the traits into the same seeds. Monsanto was soon rolling in riches thanks to farmers' reliance on Roundup and the other glyphosate herbicides Monsanto was selling for use with traditional crops, along with the booming demand for Roundup that accompanied the rollout of the company's Roundup-ready crops. Total company sales were $5.5 billion in 2000, roughly half of which came from sales of Monsanto's glyphosate herbicides. The company bragged to shareholders that it saw an 18% rise in the volume of the glyphosate products it was selling just from 1999 to 2000. And, it told them, the global market for glyphosate tripled between 1995, before glyphosate-tolerant GMO crops were introduced, and 2001. Monsanto controlled a dominant 80% or above of that global market for glyphosate. Executives explained that the gains were in part due to the growing number of acres planted around the world with its genetically altered glyphosate-tolerant crops, which at that time stood at about 118 million acres. Roundup herbicide is key to our integrated strategy, the company told investors. In addition to corn, soybeans, cotton, and canola, over the next few years, Monsanto would expand its roster of Roundup-ready crops to include alfalfa, a type of hay eaten by livestock, and sugar beets, used widely to sweeten foods and beverages. The herbicide-tolerant trait was spread throughout the seed market as Monsanto licensed its technology to over 100 seed companies in the 1990s. By 2013, Monsanto's genetic traits were embedded in more than 90% of the U.S. soybean crop and more than 80% of American corn. To ensure that farmers kept using branded Roundup rather than generics on the glyphosate-tolerant crops after glyphosate's patent expired, Monsanto tied a range of incentives and penalties to sales of its products. But the company was so aggressive in its dealings that many customers and competitors cried foul. Critics allege that Monsanto gained a market monopoly by unfairly blocking rival herbicides from the market and limiting overall competition in violation of antitrust laws. In a class action lawsuit brought against Monsanto in August 2007, Texas Grain Storage, also known as West Chemical and Fertilizer, accused Monsanto of engaging in a comprehensive anti-competitive scheme to artificially inflate the prices of Roundup. Roundup held roughly 80% of the U.S. agricultural herbicide market at that time, in part, Texas Grain alleged, because the company penalized dealers and wholesalers who sold more than a limited amount of competing generic glyphosate herbicides. Monsanto already was a major supplier of glyphosate to other agrochemical companies, but the company limited the price and the amount that rivals could sell, the lawsuit claimed. Texas Grain Storage, based in West Texas, was just a middleman, buying and storing Roundup in a stainless steel tank to resell to farmers. But the company said Monsanto kept an iron grip on its dealings, monitoring the level of Roundup that Texas Grain had in storage, and requiring Texas Grain to alert Monsanto of all sales of competing glyphosate products. Other lawsuits made similar accusations, including that Monsanto was using its market power to block rival seed developers from gaining wide distribution for their products, and exploiting that absence of competition by repeatedly raising prices for its specialty seeds. The allegations became part of an antitrust probe by the U.S. Department of Justice and several state attorney generals. Monsanto ultimately altered its contracts, and the allegations faded. But other problems dogged Monsanto's introduction of the Roundup Ready crops. Since GMOs were first introduced, regulators in the United States, Monsanto's home base, had handled oversight of biotech crops through a three-pronged system of shared responsibilities by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, the USDA, and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA. Each agency looked at the crops through a different lens, and each ultimately came under withering criticism from both internal government audits and outside environmental and consumer advocates who accused regulators of giving Monsanto far too much leeway. The U.S. Government Accountability Office, the investigative arm of the U.S. Congress, in a November 2008 report, cited several problems with biotech crop regulation. Among the many criticisms, auditors reported that regulators did little to determine whether the spread of genetic traits is causing undesirable effects on the environment, non-GE segments of agriculture, or food safety. Many complaints made their way to court. In some cases, the USDA was found to have acted illegally or carelessly in approving crops. In one notable case, a coalition of environmental groups, farmers, and consumers filed suit against the USDA in 2006 for approving Monsanto's Roundup Ready alfalfa without doing the full environmental impact study required by law. The groups argued that the genetically altered alfalfa would likely cross-pollinate with non-modified crops and contaminate conventional alfalfa supplies. Many overseas markets would not buy GMO alfalfa or other crops, and farmers stood to lose a lot of money in sales if their non-GMO crops were tainted. Another big concern was the potential for overuse of Roundup herbicide and other pesticides, as farmers, environmentalists, and some government scientists were already starting to document the rise of superweeds that had become immune to routine spraying of glyphosate. As farmers struggled to contain the resistant weeds, they dumped more and more herbicides on their fields. This chemical treadmill was harming soil health and the safety of groundwater supplies, critics said. The judge in the case, Charles R. Breyer of the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California, agreed with plaintiffs that the law had been broken, and he banned further planting of the GMO alfalfa until the government did a more thorough evaluation. An appeals court upheld the ban. The government essentially dropped out of the case and set about trying to do the analysis the court had found lacking. But Monsanto intervened and succeeded in getting the case in front of the U.S. Supreme Court in April 2010. The High Court found in Monsanto's favor in a 7-1 decision. The majority did not disagree that the USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, AFIS, had failed to follow the law by neglecting to conduct a full environmental impact study. But, the justices said, the lower court had overstepped in banning further planting of the alfalfa until the environmental impact analysis was completed. In a sharp dissent, Justice John P. Stevens was harshly critical of the majority's decision to side with Monsanto and lift the ban on the new crop, stating the environmental threat is novel. In conclusion, he stated, confronted with those disconcerting submissions, with AFIS's unlawful deregulation decision, with a group of farmers who had staked their livelihoods on AFIS's decision, and with a federal statute that prizes informed decision-making on matters that seriously affect the environment, the court did the best it could. In my view, the district court was well within its discretion to order the remedy that the court now reverses. Accordingly, I respectfully dissent. In a similar case, District Judge Jeffrey S. Wright of the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California ruled in 2009 that the USDA violated the National Environmental Policy Act when it approved Monsanto's genetically engineered sugar beets, saying the agency failed to adequately assess the impact the crops would have on the environment. The judge found that Roundup Ready sugar beets may significantly affect the environment and encouraged growers to take all efforts going forward to use conventional seed. In an August 2010 ruling, the judge formally revoked approval of the sugar beets and criticized the USDA for not taking this process seriously. After a legal scuffle over whether or not already planted seedlings would need to be pulled from farm fields, the USDA, under pressure from Monsanto, declared that it would partially deregulate the GMO sugar beets to allow for some production as it prepared the environmental impact statement it was supposed to have prepared years earlier. That final report was published in June 2012, and sugar beets were allowed back on the market. More than 1 million acres of sugar beets are cultivated each year in the United States, and most of this acreage is now planted with the glyphosate-tolerant type. While these cases dealt mainly with the government's lack of oversight, the complaints foreshadowed a barrage of threats to people and the environment as glyphosate use soared. In 1991, roughly 18.7 million pounds of glyphosate was used on crops in the United States, government figures show. By 2001, the chemical bath had reached roughly 100 million pounds, and by 2015, it had climbed to 286 million pounds. No herbicide has come remotely close to such intensive and widespread use. More than half of the glyphosate used worldwide, an estimated 56%, was sprayed on genetically altered crops by 2015. Oddly, or perhaps suspiciously, the USDA's public reporting of herbicide and other pesticide use on U.S. farms ended in 2008, and it was left primarily to academic researchers and analysts with the U.S. Department of the Interior to try to keep track of the spread of the chemicals. Monsanto was blowing smoke at EPA and claiming that herbicide use would go down, said Charles Benbrook, an agricultural industry consultant who holds a doctorate in agricultural economics and is a former director of the National Academy of Sciences Board.